Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to preview the questions. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. If you want to, you may take notes as you listen. You should mark A, B, or C. Do you have any questions? Look at the questions, then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
Today, we are going to talk a little about juvenile crime. Since the 1980s, most states in America have adopted increasingly harsh measures for dealing with juvenile offenders. But is this get-tough approach the best policy? Here is Julia Taylor to tell us more about it.
Young people who are not old enough to be legally considered adults are usually held in juvenile detention centers if they break the law. If the crime they have committed is particularly serious, they are tried as adults and sent to regular prison. Sociologist Bob Wallace, who specializes in juvenile crime, has been investigating the effectiveness of this approach to young offenders. He and journalist Susan Rolls are here today to talk about how we deal with juvenile offenders. A warm welcome to you both.
Thanks, Julia.
Happy to be here.
First of all, Susan, is it true that there has been a steady increase in crimes committed by young people?
Well, we constantly read about the increase in youth violence and crime, but the truth is much more complicated. For years, the rate of juvenile crime has been relatively steady. What has increased is youth murder. This is due to the ease with which guns can be obtained. For just $50, a kid can get hold of an illegal handgun in less than 24 hours. Nevertheless, despite the frequent attention given to murders by juveniles that we see in the headlines, these crimes make up a very small percentage of all juvenile delinquency. Approximately 6 out of 10 juveniles are tried for nonviolent crimes.
In that case, one would assume that the number of young offenders who end up in adult prisons is relatively small. But the findings of your research, Bob, have revealed that in some states, a large number of less serious offenders, convicted of drug possession, for example, are also imprisoned alongside adults.
That's right. And unfortunately, there are long-term negative implications, both for the young individuals concerned and for society at large, when juveniles spend time in adult jails. Once in prison, these young people are at great risk. Their chances of being beaten or assaulted are much higher than those of adult inmates. As a result, the incidence of suicide may increase. Furthermore, far more young people who are released from adult prisons return to crime than those tried by a juvenile court and sent to a juvenile detention center.
That's disappointing, Bob. In your opinion, what should be done to improve this situation?
What I believe is that we need to re-examine our standards and ask, what would happen if this were my child? I think we need to personalize our approach to juveniles. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't take serious action against teenage offenders. But exposing them to the extremely damaging environment of adult jails clearly does more harm than good. We must remember that young people who commit crimes will return to society someday. And so our goal must be their rehabilitation, not just their punishment. We must clean up the environment by removing weapons and drugs and by providing decent schools, sufficient jobs, and supportive community centers.
I couldn't agree more. It's high time we invested more resources and energy in the rehabilitation of juvenile offenders.
Now you will hear the segment again.
Today, we are going to talk a little about juvenile crime. Since the 1980s, most states in America have adopted increasingly harsh measures for dealing with juvenile offenders. But is this get-tough approach the best policy? Here is Julia Taylor to tell us more about it.
Young people who are not old enough to be legally considered adults are usually held in juvenile detention centers if they break the law. If the crime they have committed is particularly serious, they are tried as adults and sent to regular prison. Sociologist Bob Wallace, who specializes in juvenile crime, has been investigating the effectiveness of this approach to young offenders. He and journalist Susan Rolls are here today to talk about how we deal with juvenile offenders. A warm welcome to you both.
Thanks, Julia.
Happy to be here.
First of all, Susan, is it true that there has been a steady increase in crimes committed by young people?
Well, we constantly read about the increase in youth violence and crime, but the truth is much more complicated. For years, the rate of juvenile crime has been relatively steady. What has increased is youth murder. This is due to the ease with which guns can be obtained. For just $50, a kid can get hold of an illegal handgun in less than 24 hours. Nevertheless, despite the frequent attention given to murders by juveniles that we see in the headlines, these crimes make up a very small percentage of all juvenile delinquency. Approximately 6 out of 10 juveniles are tried for nonviolent crimes.
In that case, one would assume that the number of young offenders who end up in adult prisons is relatively small. But the findings of your research, Bob, have revealed that in some states, a large number of less serious offenders, convicted of drug possession, for example, are also imprisoned alongside adults.
That's right. And unfortunately, there are long-term negative implications, both for the young individuals concerned and for society at large, when juveniles spend time in adult jails. Once in prison, these young people are at great risk. Their chances of being beaten or assaulted are much higher than those of adult inmates. As a result, the incidence of suicide may increase. Furthermore, far more young people who are released from adult prisons return to crime than those tried by a juvenile court and sent to a juvenile detention center.
That's disappointing, Bob. In your opinion, what should be done to improve this situation?
What I believe is that we need to re-examine our standards and ask, what would happen if this were my child? I think we need to personalize our approach to juveniles. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't take serious action against teenage offenders. But exposing them to the extremely damaging environment of adult jails clearly does more harm than good. We must remember that young people who commit crimes will return to society someday, and so our goal must be their rehabilitation, not just their punishment. We must clean up the environment by removing weapons and drugs and by providing decent schools, sufficient jobs, and supportive community centers.
I couldn't agree more. It's high time we invested more resources and energy in the rehabilitation of juvenile offenders.
Number 39. Who does the reporter say is sent to a juvenile detention center? Number 40. According to Susan Rolls, why has murder by juveniles increased? Number 41. What does Susan Rolls point out about juvenile crime? Number 42. What danger of sending young people to adult prisons does Bob Wallace mention? Number 43. What does Bob Wallace recommend? Number 44. What is the purpose of this report? Look at the questions, then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
According to a recent study, vegetable consumption in the U.S. has risen by 20% over the last 25 years, but people are still not eating enough leafy green vegetables like spinach and broccoli. Mike Jennings reports.
Nutritionists advise people about their diet and eating habits. Today, Dr. Betty Nolan, a nutritionist, is going to update us on some discoveries about the foods we eat.
Did you know that half of all vegetables Americans eat are potatoes? And much of the time they are fried. Of course, potatoes are an excellent source of complex carbohydrates and fiber, as long as they're eaten in moderation and not cooked in oil or butter. However, research has shown that eating leafy green vegetables is particularly important. Women who consume at least 400 micrograms daily of folic acid, one of the B vitamins found in leafy green vegetables, reduce their risk of colon cancer by as much as 75%. However, don't assume that you can eat just any green vegetables. You may think that by adding iceberg lettuce to your salad, you are getting all the vitamins you need. In fact, experts tell us that it isn't green or leafy enough. Iceberg lettuce is barely green and is therefore not much more nutritious than water.
But a lot of people hearing this might say, why should I eat vegetables when I can simply take a pill? It makes it easier to ensure you're getting the right amount of vitamins each day.
Well, it's true that taking pills or supplements gives us some control over our daily nutritional intake. But the nutrients they provide us with are actually less effective than those found in vegetables. You see, there are certain compounds, chemical combinations, that occur naturally in food. Vegetables contain the same vitamins and minerals found in pills, but they also contain hundreds of other substances which work in combination with each other to prevent disease and strengthen the immune system. It's recently been proven that broccoli and cabbage, for example, help prevent cancer. Both these vegetables contain a chemical which, when broken down by acid in the stomach, forms compounds that prevent cells in the body from becoming cancerous. Similarly, it's been found that men in particular get health benefits from eating cooked tomatoes because they reduce the risk of prostate cancer, which attacks the male reproductive system. Onions and garlic are another example of the health-promoting properties of vegetables. It's unfortunate that the smell puts many people off eating them, because they both contain natural compounds called flavonoids, which protect your heart by lowering cholesterol.
So all the evidence indicates that a plentiful supply of vegetables in our diet has more health benefits than pills and supplements. And of course, we should also remember the importance of a varied and balanced diet, as no single food can provide us with all the nutrients our body needs.
Now you will hear the segment again.
According to a recent study, Vegetable consumption in the U.S. has risen by 20% over the last 25 years, but people are still not eating enough leafy green vegetables like spinach and broccoli. Mike Jennings reports.
Nutritionists advise people about their diet and eating habits. Today, Dr. Betty Nolan, a nutritionist, is going to update us on some discoveries about the foods we eat.
Did you know that half of all vegetables Americans eat are potatoes? And much of the time they are fried. Of course, potatoes are an excellent source of complex carbohydrates and fiber, as long as they're eaten in moderation and not cooked in oil or butter. However, research has shown that eating leafy green vegetables is particularly important. Women who consume at least 400 micrograms daily of folic acid, one of the B vitamins found in leafy green vegetables, reduce their risk of colon cancer by as much as 75%. However, don't assume that you can eat just any green vegetables. You may think that by adding iceberg lettuce to your salad, you are getting all the vitamins you need. In fact, experts tell us that it isn't green or leafy enough. Iceberg lettuce is barely green and is therefore not much more nutritious than water.
But a lot of people hearing this might say, why should I eat vegetables when I can simply take a pill? It makes it easier to ensure you're getting the right amount of vitamins each day.
Well, it's true that taking pills or supplements gives us some control over our daily nutritional intake. But the nutrients they provide us with are actually less effective than those found in vegetables. You see, there are certain compounds, chemical combinations, that occur naturally in food. Vegetables contain the same vitamins and minerals found in pills, but they also contain hundreds of other substances which work in combination with each other to prevent disease and strengthen the immune system. It's recently been proven that broccoli and cabbage, for example, help prevent cancer. Both these vegetables contain a chemical which, when broken down by acid in the stomach, forms compounds that prevent cells in the body from becoming cancerous. Similarly, it's been found that men in particular get health benefits from eating cooked tomatoes because they reduce the risk of prostate cancer, which attacks the male reproductive system. Onions and garlic are another example of the health-promoting properties of vegetables. It's unfortunate that the smell puts many people off eating them, because they both contain natural compounds called flavonoids, which protect your heart by lowering cholesterol.
So all the evidence indicates that a plentiful supply of vegetables in our diet has more health benefits than pills and supplements. And of course, we should also remember the importance of a varied and balanced diet, as no single food can provide us with all the nutrients our body needs.
Number 45. What does Dr. Nolan find surprising? Number 46. Why does Dr. Nolan mention eating salad? Number 47. Why doesn't Dr. Nolan advise taking vitamin pills? Number 48. What does Dr. Nolan say about broccoli and cabbage? Number 49. What does Dr. Nolan imply about onions and garlic? Number 50. What is the purpose of this report? End of listening test.